This is Audible.
Ride With Me presents the Williamsburg Story with Grover Gardner.
I give to Edmund Randolph, Esquire, nephew of my dear departed husband, 2 silver waiters. I give to my niece, Elizabeth Harrison, my dressing table and glass that stands in my chamber. So read the 1780 will of Betty Harrison, one of thousands of documents that would be scrutinized by researchers charged with piecing together the enormous historic jigsaw puzzle that would become restored colonial Williamsburg. Now, think for a moment what the situation was in the late 1920s. A handful of people were confronted with the challenge of changing a small, dusty Virginia town into one of America's premier historic sites. Where do you start? Mr. Edwin Kendrew, the architect who was with the project from the beginning, responds.
The need of a more comprehensive research into all of the information that could possibly be gathered about what Williamsburg looked like. In all phases of 18th century life, city plan, house plan, design of buildings, getting workmen who would understand how to use old hand planes and to fabricate things in the 18th century manner required almost a schooling. When the apprentice system, the work developed, the difficult thing was to make it clear to those responsible that this kind of work is an entirely different type of construction than current work. It required patience and care and training and data, unknown data.
Where to get the data? 18th century wills like Betty Harrison's, insurance papers, newspaper ads, letters, bills, and accounting ledgers all became invaluable clues to the restoration architects. Insurance papers were particularly helpful because some even had drawings. Dr. Goodwin himself discovered one of the early important clues, the Frenchman's map. This map was drawn by a French officer during the Revolutionary War when the French army was camped in and around the town. The officer felt the map would be helpful to other French officers trying to find their way to private homes. It showed the location of most of the houses in the town in 1790, invaluable information for 20th century architectural detectives. Dr. Goodwin's cousin, Mary Goodwin, joined in the hunt. While in London, she visited the British Museum in search of evidence that the famous British architect Sir Christopher Wren really had designed the Wren Building on the campus of William and Mary. Unfortunately, she found no such proof, and most experts today have concluded that Wren did not design his namesake building, rather it was created in the Wren style. But Mary Goodwin did find something which intrigued her. In leafing through old catalogs, she found a note referring to an early copper engraving of a village in Virginia. Could it be Williamsburg? She followed the clue to the Bodleian Library at Oxford, where she discovered a plate with the engraving, and indeed, there on the plate was a montage of early Williamsburg buildings, the Capitol, the Palace, and the Wren Building. She immediately sent a copy of the engraving to Williamsburg architects, where it arrived just in time, and they were about to start restoration on the Wren Building using assumptions that the engraving indicated were dead wrong. As the restoration project progressed, teams of architects fanned out through the South looking for early construction details in old structures. Sometimes they bought entire homes as virtual warehouses of early construction materials, windows, doors, and architectural detailing from another age. The gardens of early Williamsburg were also to be restored. Arthur D. Shercliffe, one of the founders of Harvard's Landscape Architecture School, was picked to lead the job. Mr. Shercliffe brought a unique knowledge of Southern horticulture, as well as a few eccentricities. He always wore a black greatcoat and white socks on working days. Whenever he checked into a hotel, he always carried a long rope which he tied to a radiator just in case of fire. but few questioned his imagination in creating gardens that attract flower and plant lovers from around the world, especially during Williamsburg Garden Week. The beautiful gardens of Williamsburg remind us that fences in those days were intended to keep animals out, not in. Animals used to roam Duke of Gloucester Street pretty much as they pleased, so fences were necessary to make sure they didn't make lunch out of somebody's horticultural masterpiece. Slowly, the detective work began to pay off and pieces of the great puzzle came together. In 1934, President Franklin D. Roosevelt came to town to dedicate the Duke of Gloucester Street as the most historic avenue in America. On the occasion, President Roosevelt went on to say, "What a joy to see the transformation which has taken place, to see the Capitol, the Governor's Palace, the Raleigh Tavern born again, to see 61 colonial buildings restored, 94 colonial buildings rebuilt, the magnificent gardens of colonial days reconstructed." Reverend Goodwin was there that happy day, and one can only imagine the emotions he felt when he saw his dream become reality and the curtain rise on Williamsburg's second golden age. Dr. Goodwin died on September 7, 1939. His funeral was the first service held in the restored Bruton Parish Church. He lies today in a crypt of that church, a fitting resting place for the man who many consider the hero of the Williamsburg saga. The great project was at last opened to the public. Now everyone had an opportunity to actually go back over 200 years and experience America as it stood on the threshold of revolution. So let us begin a visit to today's colonial Williamsburg. If you've been here before, we'll mention some things you might have missed on your first visit. If you're planning a visit, we'll give you some hints on how to make it most worthwhile. And if you're just listening in your favorite armchair, you'll soon understand why Williamsburg is one of America's favorite attractions. But wherever you are, make sure you use the map provided with this cassette. We're driving down Interstate 64. There are several Williamsburg exits, so if we miss the first, don't worry, we'll take the next, and just follow the green and white Colonial Williamsburg signs which lead to the visitor's center. There's plenty of parking, and a shuttle bus will take us to the historic district. As we enter the visitor's center, there's a large-scale model of Colonial Williamsburg, which we should take a few minutes to study and orient ourselves with our own map. There are a row of ticket windows on one side of the center and a row of special service booths on the other. Now, we want to be a little careful buying our ticket. Some visitors march right up to the ticket window and buy a ticket which doesn't include special attractions they really want to see. Others, with limited time, buy a more expensive pass that offers them access to much more than they can possibly see in the time they have available. Many people ask how long should one allow for a Williamsburg visit. 3 days would allow ample time to explore all the Williamsburg mysteries, but if you really hustle and use your time wisely, you can probably see a representative cross-section in one day. Well, we have plenty of time, and we want to explore everything, so we choose a Patriot's Pass, which is good for a full year and admits us just about every place. Pass firmly in hand, we cross to the special service booths to study the restaurant menus and prices at the various Williamsburg taverns. At these booths, we can make reservations for the restaurants and special events Williamsburg offers, which include everything from walking tours at night with guides leading the way by lantern light to 18th-century plays and fancy dress balls at the palace. Because we planned this trip right, after all, you are listening to this tape, we've a pretty good idea of what we want to see and do and arrange our schedule accordingly. In the visitor center, you can also watch the 35-minute motion picture Story of a Patriot, unless you've already seen it at one of the local motels, which show it on the closed-circuit TV. The movie tells the story of a fictional 18th-century planter who finds himself torn between those who want to remain tied to England and a growing group who want to start a new nation. You can guess which he chooses. The film was shot on location in Williamsburg, and the actor portraying the young plantation owner will certainly look familiar, because he is Jack Lord, who went on to fame as the hard-bitten star of the hit TV series Hawaii Five-O. There's a funny story about the filming of that movie. Obviously, when doing a film set in an historic period, the director has to be careful that modern things don't sneak into the background. There can't be any jet contrails in the sky over 18th century Williamsburg, or the sound of honking horns. Well, after hours of work and waiting for the perfect, quiet moment to shoot a scene in front of one of the restored buildings, the director shouted, "Roland!" The scene was going without a hitch, when suddenly the crew heard a squeaking noise, and a 20th-century paperboy on a bicycle wheeled into the scene and tossed a newspaper over the heads of the startled actors. The whole scene had to be reshot, and the director was heard to mumble afterwards that the free newspaper had cost him a small fortune. So when you're watching the film and see Jack Lord in front of one of the restored homes, visualize a newspaper sailing over his head. One last stop in the visitor center. Let's go to the bookstore and buy the official guide to Colonial Williamsburg. It's good, inexpensive, and provides very valuable information on all the places we'll be visiting. Okay, head down the escalators, onto the shuttle bus, and away we go for our date with history. The buses run constantly during visiting hours, and you can get on and off at any of 10 different stops by just flashing your ticket. Now, remember, these old buildings are not just museums. They are a true link with our past. Real people lived, worked, and died here. Each place has its own story, and to really appreciate the drama of Williamsburg, you should spend time to learn those stories. Here are a few samples and some sightseeing tips. I suggest you get off the bus at Market Square, stop number 2 on our map, and walk straight ahead to the old courthouse. Walk up Duke of Gloucester Street until you reach the Palace Green, the long lawn that stretches from the street to the Governor's Palace. Stand in the center of Duke of Gloucester Street, facing the palace. Don't worry, there's no traffic during the day, so you're not going to get hit by a car, although you might keep an eye open for a passing carriage. Now, slowly turn to the left, making a complete circle, and watch for 5 towers or steeples. The first will be on the palace directly ahead of you. Next will be the steeple of Bruton Parish Church. Further down the street is the tower atop the Wren Building at the beginning of the William and Mary campus. Keep turning. Next you will see the tower with the clock on top of the Capitol Building at the opposite end of Duke of Gloucester Street. Finally, there is the tower of the nearby courthouse. Those 5 towers roughly mark the boundaries of the historic area, which is just over a mile long and about a half mile wide. If you get lost during the day and worry that you may be walking away from the historic area, just head for a building with a tower, and you'll soon be back on track. The towers also mark 5 of the most important buildings in Colonial Williamsburg. If you have limited time, try and see as many of these tower buildings as possible. The Capitol and the Governor's Palace are certainly must-sees. Because long lines can form quickly in front of these buildings, especially during the summer, try to get there as soon as they open, usually around 9 a.m. After you've seen Governor's Palace and the Capitol, try and include a cross-section of Williamsburg, which should include at least one of the following types of attractions: a private home, a workshop, a store, a tavern, and finally, Bruton Parish Church. If you do at least that much, believe me, you'll return home with lots of memories and dinner conversation for weeks to come. I want to say a few words about the Governor's Palace that was so highly recommended by Captain Duncan Stewart, who you may meet on the streets. Completed in 1722, the palace was designed to be the finest building in British America, a fitting symbol of the king's power in the new country. It served as the home of 7 royal governors and, after the Revolutionary War, housed the state of Virginia's first 2 governors, Patrick Henry and Thomas Jefferson. It's important to keep in mind how grand this building was by early Virginia standards. Few homes in this area had interior plaster or even window glass. The governor's palace, with its high ceilings, beautiful wood paneling, furniture imported from around the world, and formal gardens, was a showpiece unlike anything ever seen before in the New World. In 1758, hailstones about 1.5 inch thick broke every precious pane of glass in the palace and destroyed every plant in the garden. The resident royal governor, Francis Fauquier, even wrote an article about the freak storm for a British scientific organization. Trying to make the best of a bad situation, The governor directed his staff to gather up all the hailstones and use them to cool his wine and help make ice cream, a popular dessert among the gentry. Two capitol buildings had been erected in Williamsburg in the 18th century, both burned to their foundations in disastrous fires. The 20th century architects reconstructed the first building, which had two turret-like structures joined in the center by a meeting area. The general court met in one turret. The legislature, called the House of Burgesses, met in the other. It was in the Williamsburg House of Burgesses that Patrick Henry delivered some of his most fiery speeches. Here's a point that many visitors to Williamsburg miss. If you look through the windows of the Capitol or of the other Williamsburg buildings, you'll notice that most of the objects in the room look distorted, as if seen in a funhouse mirror. Why is that? Well, the answer illustrates the point Mr. Kendrew made about training workers to work in the 18th century way. Early glassmakers made window panes by first blowing a large blob of molten glass into glass balls 5 feet in diameter. The balls were then rapidly spun about, creating elongated flat surfaces. The panes were cut from these relatively flat surfaces. I say relatively because most of the panes retained some of the curve of the bubble, which distorts the light passing through. When reconstructing the old buildings, modern artisans made the panes the same way, even reproducing the same distortion. That's a trivia question many of the other visitors won't be able to answer. Bruton Parish Church has witnessed hundreds of stories. For example, in 1907, when the church became part of the festivities surrounding the 300th anniversary of the founding of Jamestown, some residents proposed paving the Duke of Gloucester Street, which was then nothing but mud. This upstart idea infuriated the traditional townsfolk. They maintained that since Washington, Jefferson, and Henry had walked in the mud to worship at Bruton Parish Church, so too can everyone else. Maybe I should clarify the meaning of two terms frequently used in connection with Williamsburg, restoration and reconstruction. Restoration is the preservation of an existing structure and its original parts. Reconstruction refers to the complete reproduction of an early building which no longer existed. The reconstruction is based on the shape of the existing foundation, early drawings, or other research data. Facing the palace green just behind Bruton Parish Church stands the Wythe House, once owned by George Wythe, one of the most influential behind-the-scenes men of the American Revolution. A lawyer by the age of 20 and a lifelong scholar of the classics, he was a close friend of Thomas Jefferson and John Marshall, later Chief Justice of the United States. Wythe was the first professor of law at an American college and, in fact, was a teacher of both Jefferson and Marshall. His Williamsburg home was George Washington's headquarters before the siege of Yorktown. It's a handsome brick building with four spacious rooms and a wide hallway on each floor. In Wythe's time, the servants would unroll their mats and sleep in these hallways. One might well envy Mr. Wythe's beautiful home, except for one thing. It was the cause of his murder. The house was originally built in 1754 as a wedding present to Wythe by the bride's father. Years later, after his wife had died, Wythe invited his impoverished nephew George Sweeney to live in the house. Soon, Sweeney developed a desperate need to possess the house. He was the principal beneficiary of Wythe's will, but he apparently couldn't wait for nature to take its course, so one night in 1806 he served his famous uncle a cup of coffee sweetened with sugar and arsenic. Unfortunately for Sweeney, Wythe lived for 2 weeks, long enough to disinherit his impatient nephew. George Sweeney was arrested for murder because there had been a witness to the crime, a servant who slept in the large hallway. But the servant was a slave. Because Virginia courts would not admit the testimony of a slave, George Sweeney, murderer of a signer of the Declaration of Independence, went free. The Anderson Blacksmith Shop is typical of the many early workshops operating at Williamsburg and of the skilled craftsmen who have spent much of their lives mastering the vanishing 18th century skills. Any visitor to Williamsburg should take time to chat with these craftsmen who are almost living history books. In the 18th century, boys as young as 13 and 14 worked in forges as apprentices, without pay. They worked next to journeymen, experienced workers who were paid for their work. A master blacksmith was in charge, but in those days the term master didn't necessarily imply any degree of skill. It simply designated the person who owned the shop. If you think blacksmithing is just heating metal and mindlessly pounding it into different shapes, Anderson's blacksmith shop is a real eye-opener. Take the ordinary horseshoe, for example. Most of us don't realize that a horse's feet aren't all the same. Each shoe had to be of a certain shape and weight to fit each individual hoof. Some shoes might be thicker or thinner to help correct the defect in the horse's gait. So tip your hat to a blacksmith pounding away at the red-hot metal. He may be the traditional brawny, hairy-chested giant, but he may also have the keen eye of a surgeon. The Margaret Hunter shop on Duke of Gloucester Street is a typical retail store of the 1770s. That was the year Margaret Hunter placed an ad in the Virginia Gazette offering jet necklaces, earrings, women's and children's riding habits, and busts of the late Lord Botetourt. For those of you who might not recognize the name, Lord Botetourt was an early Williamsburg governor. Other items in the display case indicate that Margaret Hunter did not limit her stock to apparel or busts of obscure British nobility. She also sold items such as candlesticks, shoes, and liquor. But, alas, because of current Virginia state liquor laws, the restored Hunter shop can't display any liquor, even in the interests of 18th century authenticity. Being a colonial fashion plate was no easy job. Wigs were, of course, popular with gentlemen of the day, many of whom shaved their head to ensure that the wig was a good fit. One might wonder how people paid for things in Williamsburg before plastic credit cards. Sometimes cash was in short supply. Here's what Jane Vobe, keeper of the King's Arms Tavern, has to say about payment of bills by some of her more boisterous clients.
Paris and some of the gentry, you know. And when they get into the liquor, take to breaking things. And being of the gentry, you'd not be allowed to ask them to pay for it. I'm not pleased when I see them coming, sir. As long as they pay their account when they leave the city, I find them quite in favor. There's men that say there is no money here, sir. But keeping a public house, I can tell you that if a man wishes a bowl of punch, he most always can find a bit of money. But upon the books, credit is good. And tobacco credits I would take. And well, if there's country produce to be had in the summer, it would not trouble me to take that, sir.
Almost all stores accepted tobacco notes, Jane mentioned. Tobacco was, of course, a primary cash crop of the early colonies. After harvest, the planter would take the leaves to a warehouse to be weighed and stored in casks, clearly marked with the planter's initials. The planter was issued a tobacco note, which was simply a warehouse receipt certifying that so much tobacco was on deposit at the warehouse. This note became currency because anyone, such as Jane Vobe, could reclaim the tobacco simply by presenting the note to the warehouseman. Taxes were even paid in tobacco notes. In the middle of the 18th century, the royal governor authorized paper money for the crown colony of Virginia. Counterfeit money became a problem, so prominent government officials began to sign and date each bill. When Virginia became a state, the government took an even stronger stand. On every $200 bill were printed the words, "Death to Counterfeit." Unintimidated, the industrious counterfeiters simply added the threatening words to their own handiwork. Here's another colonial quiz question. In some of the restored Williamsburg homes, all the chairs are pushed flat against the wall in some of the rooms. Now, why do you suppose our colonial ancestors did that? Were they just super neat, or might there have been another reason? Think about it for a few minutes. Meanwhile, I suggest you turn the tape off for a while and take a rest. When we come back, I'll give you some backstage glimpses of how this enormous Williamsburg project is run today. See you in a little while. Welcome back. Here's the answer to why many early Williamsburg residents stacked their chairs against the wall. It wasn't neatness, it was light, or more accurately, the absence of light. Remember, the early homes were illuminated by candlelight. To get to the candle holders to light the candles, the residents frequently had to walk through a dark room. Now, what happens when you walk through a dark room filled with furniture? Right, you crack your shins on something. To minimize the risk involved in running such an obstacle course, our practical patriots simply formed the habit when they left the room of moving the chairs out of the way. The Prentice store on Duke of Gloucester Street recently celebrated its 250th anniversary. It's the only original store building still surviving in Williamsburg. Other than that, it seems an unremarkable place, except that the Prentice store was involved in an incident that added to the revolutionary fervor of the times, all because William Prentice forgot to cancel an order. It was 1774. To protest the British closing of Boston Harbor after the famous Boston Tea Party, many Williamsburg merchants boycotted British goods. Prentice either forgot he had ordered some of the infamous tea from Britain, or the cancellation order didn't reach the wholesalers, but whatever, a British ship arrived at Yorktown loaded with tea for the Prentice store. A committee of local merchants organized to enforce the boycott was outraged. In the dark of night, they stole aboard the ship and, emulating their patriot colleagues in Boston, dumped the offending leaves into the York River. The event never captured the colonial imagination like the more famous Boston incident, maybe because the York River Tea Party just didn't have the right ring to it. But nevertheless, Williamsburg merchants made their protest, and the tea-drinking customers of the Prentice store had to make their sacrifice for independence. Photography is very popular with Williamsburg visitors. Kids love to pose with their hands in the old stocks near the courthouse. Certainly keeps them still for a while. Another very popular photo backdrop is the magazine, site of another historic event during revolutionary times. In 1775, enthusiasm for independence was growing throughout the colonies, a development of great concern to Royal Governor Dunsmore. He became increasingly worried about all the gunpowder stored in the magazine. With trouble brewing, it wouldn't do at all to have those revolutionary firebrands in possession of all that powder. So he ordered the Royal Marines to steal it. When the loss was discovered, Williamsburg residents were outraged and organized a small army led by, who else, Patrick Henry. The group marched down Duke of Gloucester Street to the Capitol and demanded that Governor Dunsmore either return the powder or pay for it. Dunsmore chose to pay. Ironically, almost on that very day, news reached Williamsburg of the battles in Lexington and Concord, and that the Revolutionary War had started. Here's another tip for visitors to the historic area. As you walk around, it's a good idea to glance up occasionally. You may see things other visitors miss. For example, above Raleigh Tavern is a bust of Sir Walter Raleigh. Using busts of famous people to identify buildings is a custom that dates back to Roman times. You will also see many pictorial signs hanging from buildings. A grocer displays an iron cutout of a pig. In front of John Greenhouse's store, a picture of a sailing ship indicates the store carries imported goods. These signs were much more important in colonial times than they might be today. Why do you think that is? I'm sure you guessed correctly that it was because many early Williamsburg residents could not read. This was particularly true of servants who did much of the shopping. The picture signs identified the business of the store. Look at the map of Williamsburg provided with this cassette and find the DeWitt Wallace Decorative Arts Gallery. It's in the lower left-hand corner of the map, behind the public hospital. Find it? Well, like almost every other building, there's an interesting story behind the gallery. By now you realize that each building in the historic area is a mini-museum filled with works of art, furnishings, and everyday objects used by people in the 18th century. Some of these objects were in the old Williamsburg homes, but not nearly enough to furnish and decorate all the buildings standing today. Where did the rest of it all come from? Restoration decorators faced a real problem. The South had preserved many historic buildings, but had lagged far behind New England and the Midwest in documenting the furnishings of those buildings. The decorators thus had very little information to work with. So they fanned out through the South and even overseas, buying whole collections of 18th-century objects that might have been used in Williamsburg. However, over the years, continuing research and new discoveries provided a much more accurate picture of the inside of the restored buildings. In the interests of historic authenticity, the decorators used only those objects that were most likely to have been in the original setting. All well and good, but what were they going to do with the thousands of beautiful items already collected but now not considered appropriate for the historic area? At first they were just warehoused out of sight, but everybody knew that was an unsatisfactory solution. One good solution would be to create a special museum, but that would cost a lot of money, which would not be available from the Rockefeller's Williamsburg account. Where to find the money? The answer? Do what Dr. Goodwin did. Find a generous millionaire. And find one they did, Mr. DeWitt Wallace, founder of one of the best-read magazines in the world, The Reader's Digest. Wallace was fascinated by Williamsburg, and he and his wife visited frequently. Reader's Digest staff members were even sent for weekend history refreshers. So the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation approached Mr. Wallace with some funding ideas. Hey, it worked with Mr. Rockefeller, and it worked with Mr. Wallace, who agreed on a project that would add a totally new dimension to the historic preservation. But there was yet another problem. Under the covenants established by Mr. Rockefeller, no modern structure could be built in the historic district. The architects came up with a very imaginative way of keeping the new museum in and out of the historic district. At the time, the public hospital, which had housed mental patients from all over the young nation, was being restored. The plans were adapted to allow for a 65-foot underground passage, which would originate in the restored hospital and lead out to the new museum. The only portion of the museum that would appear above ground was to look like an old English wall. Thus it was done, and a new jewel was added to the Williamsburg crown. And what a dazzling jewel it is! Ms. Carolyn Wheatley, director of the gallery, was asked about the best way for first-time visitors to see the gallery.
The advice I would give them is to spend some time in the introductory gallery, understanding what the decorative arts are all about, what their place is in Colonial Williamsburg. The objects that we display here are really out of historical context, and we display them for the qualities of the objects themselves, principally aesthetic qualities. And I would ask that they spend a fair amount of time in the Masterworks Gallery. The gallery has a lot of different kinds of objects, and there's some galleries that are devoted exclusively to furniture, exclusively to ceramics, exclusively to metalwares, or exclusively to textiles. But Masterworks includes all kinds of objects, and it's one of the few spaces where you see a variety and range. So you would get a good indication of what's in the study galleries around that, and also the quality of the material that we have in the collection.
I asked about any special pieces in the gallery.
Compion clock is a very important piece. There's several paintings that are important. There are examples by Charles Wilson Peale, for instance, including a wonderful portrait of George Washington, and several pieces of important, very important Philadelphia furniture. And an extraordinary chest on chest, which is from Philadelphia, and one of the rarest pieces around. Unusual ceramics, the monkey band, which is a whole set of figurines or figures of monkeys playing different instruments. It's an extraordinary commentary on 18th century humor and a wonderful piece. And then there's another English Delftware figure of, again, humorous. It's called Mr. Nobody, and it literally is a figure with a head and legs, but no body.
Well, I guess we can see why some people call the Wallace Gallery the attic of Colonial Williamsburg. Some attic. Restoration of Colonial Williamsburg helped solve one of our country's oldest mysteries. Why did the impoverished residents of Old Williamsburg generally live longer than the well-to-do gentry? The digging archaeologists provided at least part of the answer by uncovering beautiful pewter cups and bowls. The rich loved such elegance on their tables. The poor, however, could only afford crude wood or iron implements. Lucky them. Recent chemical analysis of the beautiful pottery has shown very high lead contents. It is now believed that many rich died young of lead poisoning. I've mentioned Bassett Hall several times during our ride today. This lovely 18th century home for 30 years served as the Rockefeller Williamsburg residence. When John D. Rockefeller Jr. died in 1960, the house and furnishings were kept exactly as he had known them. It can be described as a comfortable museum with 125 pieces of folk art collected by Rockefeller's wife, Abby. Perhaps more than anyone else in this country, Abby Rockefeller championed this art of the common people. The paintings were executed by hands and eyes that never saw the inside of an art school. But if they were crude, they were also filled with life and energy. Some of the folk art, however, is a little comical. Take, for example, the Bassett Hall painting, which depicts Washington's famous crossing of the Delaware. If one looks closely at the position of the oars in that painting, it becomes clear the soldiers were rowing against each other. If they kept that up, poor George would have spent that frosty night in the middle of the river simply turning in circles. The kitchen and pantry at Bassett Hall has storage space for 17 separate sets of dishes. Mr. Rockefeller ordinarily disdained conspicuous consumption, but he did like to dine on plates that had a different pattern for each meal. From time to time, the Rockefellers invited local residents to dinner. Each evening was always the same. The Rockefeller limousine would pick up the guests and deliver them to Bassett Hall at precisely 6 p.m. Dinner would last just 45 minutes. Then the Rockefellers and their guests would ride in the limousine to the Williamsburg Theater and sit in the last row, which was always reserved for them, to watch a movie. Then the limousine would carry the guests back to their residence while the Rockefellers walked back to Bassett Hall. Hardly the elaborate parties or wild nights on the town we've come to expect of contemporary millionaires. Remember when visiting Bassett Hall to ask the guide to point out the mysterious inscription, May 23, 1862, in the morning room. Before you leave Bassett Hall, stand for a moment at the front door and look toward the Capitol building. The trees appear to block your view, but if you look up, you'll see they've been trimmed to frame a circular view of the flag flying over the Capitol. Rockefeller himself arranged for this because he liked to walk out his door and see the Capitol Tower first thing in the morning. Well, in the past few minutes, I've told you a dozen stories about some of the places at Williamsburg. These have just been a small sampling of the tales that await a visitor, but I hope they've demonstrated what I said earlier. Williamsburg is not just a bunch of old buildings. It is the complete recreation of a period of our past, a period complete with sorrow, joy, and the tribulations of everyday life. Learning these stories enables the wise visitors to experience Williamsburg. And visitors come by the millions. Williamsburg has attracted the rich and famous from around the world, many of whom added their own stories to the legends that surround this old town. In 1945, Dwight D. Eisenhower and Winston Churchill, fresh from leading the victorious Allied forces in World War II, came to see Williamsburg. Churchill traveled by train from Washington and played gin rummy most of the time with the president of Colonial Williamsburg, who recalled that during the card game, Churchill briskly discarded the King of Hearts, saying, "Who wants any quarter with royalty?" One hand later, he picked up the King of Clubs and mumbled, "Well, somebody has to look after them." Historian Park Rouse recalls the time the Queen of England visited Colonial Williamsburg, accompanied by her husband, Prince Philip. A great party was given for the royal couple in the gardens of the governor's palace. One woman, talking with Philip, said, "Talking with you here, Your Highness, makes me feel almost British." Prince Philip, son of Prince Andrew of Greece, deadpanned his reply, "I don't know why, madam. I'm Greek myself." In 1983, Williamsburg made world headlines when the 9th Annual Summit of Industrialized Nations met in Williamsburg, and such heads of state as President Ronald Reagan and British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher walked the streets once trod by Jefferson and Washington. But it was not the rich and famous that visionary Reverend Goodwin had in mind when he first conceived of a restored Williamsburg. It was people like you and me, just normal citizens coming to see something of our past. And each year, over 1 million of us visit Williamsburg. Managing this enormous project and all those people is the responsibility of the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, a nonprofit educational organization. It employs 4,500 people to maintain what is a combination small town and world's largest indoor-outdoor museum. This staff consists of a couple of hundred character interpreters, 150 gardeners, 2,000 people working on educational projects, 100 colonial actors and musicians, plus assorted hostesses, archaeologists, mechanics, construction people, waiters, bellmen, and even shepherdesses. Wouldn't that be a great line at a party? What do you do for a living? Oh, I'm a shepherdess. Williamsburg employees also staff 20 craft shops where artisans using the 18th century tools make the same items made by our colonial ancestors, which are sold today in the same stores that sold them over 200 years ago. Some Williamsburg visitors order special items they want made, a practice so popular that items have to be ordered months or even years in advance. The practical among us always wonder how much something like Williamsburg is worth today. It's priceless, of course, but estimates of its dollar worth vary widely. We do know, however, that John D. Rockefeller invested a total of $90 million in Williamsburg from 1926 until he died in 1960. Asked to offer a guess about today, one Williamsburg spokesperson said, "It's impossible to put a realistic figure on all the property and collections. However, if just one 18th century chest-on-chest from the Colonial Williamsburg collection were auctioned at Christie's, it might bring over $1 million, and that's only one piece in one house. You calculate what a total might be." What's ahead? Is the Colonial Williamsburg project basically completed, and will it be the same 5 years hence? No, it isn't finished. It's constantly changing and expanding to adjust to new archaeological discoveries and historic research. More buildings are being restored or reconstructed. The Abby Aldrich Rockefeller Art Center is being enlarged. At Carter's Grove, a few miles down Route 60, just the other side of Busch Gardens Amusement Park, Williamsburg archaeologists in 1970 rediscovered Wolstenholme, a tiny hamlet established in 1619 but erased from the landscape 3 years later by rampaging Indians. Wolstenholme has been completely restored and is now another link with our distant past. Yes, Williamsburg is constantly changing. It is open 365 days a year and offers over 40 different activities which change with the seasons, highlighted by the popular Christmas at Williamsburg. What's it all mean? What is the significance of Colonial Williamsburg? Architect Edwin Kendrew, looking back over nearly 70 years' association with Williamsburg, summarized it this way.
I think that the lesson Williamsburg has to offer is of sufficient importance to any thinking American that he will benefit by knowing what his forefathers did and how carefully they laid out the town, how skillfully they arranged the traditional architecture to respect modern condition, and really ingenious way in which they created a very beautiful and livable town, I think is a great lesson to people today.
We are fortunate to be living in the second golden age of Williamsburg. I can think of no more fitting way for your ride with me to end than by quoting the motto adopted by Williamsburg, that the future may learn from the past. We want to thank Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, the character interpreters, Ms. Carolyn Weekly, Mr. Park Rouse, and especially Mr. Edwin Kendrew for sharing with us their insights, without which this program would not have been possible. This is Grover Gardner saying farewell until the next time you ride with me. Do you remember the movie Back to the Future, in which a mad scientist climbed into Hollywood's version of a time machine and drove back to the future? Their time machine was one of those fancy DeLorean automobiles with doors that open up like a gull's wings. Well, our car may not be a DeLorean, but it is about to become a time machine, because we are going to ride together back over three centuries, back to the earliest settlement in America, and then we'll switch the dials to forward and relive the development of one of the nation's most remarkable achievements, Colonial Williamsburg. 18th-century Williamsburg was really a pretty good preview of the 20th-century United States. You know, almost every major political institution we have today was created before the year 1800. I'm talking about things like the concept of a government of, by, and for the people, the separation of church and state, the dominance of civil authority over the military. While these ideas existed in one form or another for centuries, the pen of Thomas Jefferson and the tongue of Patrick Henry gave them new vigorous meaning as these early patriots met in Williamsburg. But the legacy of Williamsburg isn't just political. It touched our lives in more direct ways. You probably have Williamsburg reminders right in your own hometown. Any Williamsburg houses in your neighborhood? Williamsburg furniture in your home? Colonial crafts in your den? Know any very bright person who made Phi Beta Kappa in college? That intellectual society started in Williamsburg. Every school child knows stories about Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, but did you ever wonder where they went to school? That's right, Williamsburg. Today, restored Colonial Williamsburg stands as one of the world's finest examples of painstaking historic research and provides unique opportunities for first-hand experience of America's past. But this isn't going to be just a stuffy history lesson, the kind that was always good for a snooze in the fifth grade. We'll share some backstreet gossip about America's founding fathers, talk with some of the people who bring Colonial Williamsburg to life every day, and learn some inside information and sightseeing shortcuts. Whether you're visiting now, planning a visit later, or reliving an earlier visit, you'll be glad you took this ride with me to Colonial Williamsburg. So, latch up your seatbelt and let's get moving. Look at a map of Virginia. Colonial Williamsburg is located right in the middle of a peninsula in the southeast part of the state. The peninsula is shaped like a crooked finger, pointing at the cities of Norfolk and Virginia Beach. The York River, which ultimately trapped the British Army at Yorktown, flows along the top of this finger, meeting Chesapeake Bay just about where you'd expect to find a fingernail. The James River, the water highway followed by the first English settlers who founded Jamestown, rushes along the bottom of the finger. Did you find it? Historians call this little section of Virginia the Historic Triangle because it contains three of the most important locations of early American history: Williamsburg, Yorktown, and Jamestown. The 100 or so sturdy English men and boys who arrived in the New World in 1607 made the mistake of settling on a low, swampy island. They named it Jamestown after the king, and despite the miserable conditions, succeeded in making it the first permanent English settlement in the New World. It was a raw wilderness filled with mosquitoes and armed local residents who felt, with considerable justification, that they owned the land. Within 6 months of arrival, nearly half those settlers died of disease and starvation, and it was only Captain John Smith's skill in making friends with the Indians and the timely arrival of a supply ship that the rest were saved. In 1633, 99 years before George Washington was born, some Jamestown homesteaders drifted to the middle of the peninsula. They built a few scattered farmhouses on the good, dry soil that was perfect for growing tobacco, the cash crop that supported the colony. Unlike Jamestown, this area was free of mosquitoes and malaria. Soon the farmhouses were joined by a church, one of the earliest in America, Bruton Parish, and the country's second college, William and Mary. Because it was in the middle of the peninsula, the new little settlement was called Middle Plantation. England had established Jamestown as the capital of the royal colony of Virginia, and had sent a succession of royal governors to rule in the king's name. It wasn't too long before many Jamestown residents, weary of their swamp-filled area, decided that the tobacco leaves looked greener in the middle plantation. When the Capitol building in Jamestown burned down for the fourth time, the governor cried enough, and in 1699 moved to Middle Plantation, which, to honor the king then on the throne of England, was renamed Williamsburg. The first golden age of Williamsburg was about to begin. The governor at that time was a gentleman by the name of Francis Nicholson. Well, maybe gentleman isn't exactly the right word. Because of all the stories in our history books, we tend to think of the early pioneers as hardy saints. Well, Nicholson may have been hardy, but he certainly was no saint. One contemporary noted that Nicholson spent much of his time chasing rich young women. When one such lass spurned him, he flew into a towering rage and threatened harm to her, her fiancé, and any minister who would dare marry the pair. But Nicholson had at least one great redeeming trait. He turned out to be a very astute urban planner, and in the first attempt at city planning in America, he drafted the plans for the new town of Williamsburg. Nicholson had almost a clean slate to work on. Only a few structures dotted the landscape. The two main buildings, located on opposite ends of a meandering horse trail, were the Wren Building of William and Mary College and Bruton Parish Church. Nicholson envisioned a grand 99-foot-wide boulevard that would extend from the college, past the church, to a major new structure, the Capitol Building. The governor wanted to avoid the crowded look of London, where houses and shops were crunched against each other. The new Williamsburg was to be divided into spacious half-acre lots, guarded by some of America's first zoning laws. Each house was to be set back at least 6 feet from the road and must stand at least 10 feet high to the edge of the roof. Once a settler bought land, he was required to build a house within 24 months or lose title to the land. Quite an incentive for breaking out the hammer and nails. Governor Nicholson named the main boulevard Duke of Gloucester, after the 9-year-old heir to the British throne. Unfortunately, the boy died just 2 years later without ever seeing his street namesake. He survives today, however, in a huge portrait that hangs in the Capitol Building. Nicholson's plan called for two other main avenues, running parallel to and on either side of Duke of Gloucester Street. Ah, but what to name them? In an inspiration, two names came to him. He would call one Francis and the other Nicholson. Francis and Nicholson sounded just right to the ear of Governor Francis Nicholson. In the midst of his planning, he had another idea, perhaps after tippling too much rum. Instead of a series of straight intersecting streets, why not cite some streets so they would form a W and an M in honor of England's royal couple William and Mary? That would be a nice touch that should please the folks back in London, he reasoned. Mercifully for those future travelers who might dead-end in a maze of W and M streets, this particular Nicholson idea was never carried out. Colonial Williamsburg, home to so many of the new nation's best and brightest, became with Boston one of the major seedbeds of the American Revolution. In 1765, the British Parliament passed the Stamp Act, which many colonists considered a prime example of the infamous British practice of taxation without representation. Protesting the unjust act, Patrick Henry rose from his seat in the House of Burgesses meeting in Williamsburg and spoke fiery words that helped start a revolution. Caesar had his Brutus, Charles I his Cromwell, and George III may profit by their example. If this be treason, make the most of it. Many people thought that's just what it was, and cries of treason, treason echoed through the Capitol building, but the genie of revolution was uncapped that day in Williamsburg, not to be sealed back in the bottle until the British defeat at nearby Yorktown 16 years later. There are many stories about the rich and famous of those days, but what was it like to be just an ordinary mortal in pre-revolutionary Williamsburg? People like you and me, concerned with paying our bills, raising our kids, and enjoying a little leisure time. The genius of today's colonial Williamsburg is not just that early buildings are restored. Through the artistry of modern-day character interpreters, the lives of the earliest residents were also restored. Today, we can talk to individuals so well-versed in the history of the characters they represent that it is like talking to an 18th-century Williamsburg citizen. Still, tourists love to try and trip them up by asking questions such as, "Did you serve in World War II?" only to be met by a response such as, "Are you referring to that recent unpleasantness when Colonel Washington fought the Indians?" Now it's time to get in our time machine. We'll set the dials for about 1770 and head for Williamsburg. Hang on. Presto. We're now walking along Duke of Gloucester Street in 1770. It's early in the morning, a very good time to visit. Men and women are hurrying to their places of business, opening shops, carrying wood, firing hearths. This is a small town. It only has a population of about 2,000, half of whom were blacks. Colonial Williamsburg could not have functioned and prospered without the 50% of its inhabitants who were slaves. Unless we have friends in town, we should see to our night's lodgings. There are 8 taverns to choose from. You'd better be a man if you want to check into one of these hostelries for the night. Although some places have a few small rooms for families, most just offer bed space for men, 2 to a bed. Women were expected to stay with friends, or just stay home. Ah, here's a clean-looking establishment, apparently kept by this woman. What might your name be?
Oh, it is Jane Rhodes, sir, keeper of the King's Arms Tavern, here in Williamsburg. I own the tavern. I see to the keeping of the slaves and the animals and the guests when they're present, sir, to their bed spaces and their punch and the things that gentlemen desire when they travel to the city. Oh, I am well set up, sir, for the complete entertainment of a gentleman. I have 14 chambers, 4 stairways, a bar, and 2 porches, and well, presently I'm able to keep it to only 2 men to a bed, sir. So it's 7.5 pence for a sleeping space and 1 shilling for each meal. There is breakfast and dinner and supper, sir. And at the 1 shilling meal, it is a common table, and you'd be served from what is set there. If you'd wish something that is not set there, we can negotiate the price for a private dinner, sir. Oh, something that the gentlemen favor the most of all is the roast tongue and udder with the ginger sauce, sir. Oh, there is ham, of course. Perhaps a bit of something else left from the meal before. A fine onion pie, a boiled pudding with beans, lemon cheesecakes, and apple tarts, perhaps.
Roast tongue and udder. Sounds delicious. Around Market Square, there are many women and slaves buying fresh vegetables, eggs, butter, and meats from the farmers who display their wares on pine board stands. Food shopping is a daily chore in these times before refrigeration, but be careful if you see a loose pig. Let it alone. Pig stealing is a major crime and a hanging offense on the 3rd conviction. Over there by the courthouse stands a whipping post and a pillory where minor criminals are punished. More serious offenders are hauled off to the jail next to the Capitol, where they might be chained to the wall. These early residents were certainly not soft on crime. Behind the Capitol, the colonial militia is drilling on a wide field. If we have time, we can stroll uptown toward William and Mary College, or stop in Bruton Parish Church, or visit one of the wealthy families that live in the 2-story mansions in that fashionable part of town. The shopping area is downtown, near the Capitol building. Oh, here comes a gentleman dressed in seaman's garb. Excuse me, sir. May I ask your name?
Captain Duncan Stewart.
Captain, we're new to Williamsburg. What do you think of this town? Do you come here often?
Nay, sir, just betwixt voyages. It's a poor place for a capital here. It's not a seaport, sir, and I, being a sailor, would come here for political reasons, mainly obtain passes, meet with merchants and such as that. It's a pretty enough town, sir, a pretty enough town indeed. The street is straight, sir, a nice channel, and we sailors love a straight channel, sir. I'll tell you that, and I can see the college down at the western end of Duke of Gloucester Street, sir, and our brave capital lies at the eastern end. Oh, it's a pretty sight, sir, and our governor's palace. Finest building I ever seen in any of these colonies, sir. The latest design and fashion of London town, I'm told, sir. Fine checkered chair covers and paintings of your majesty, sir. It's a fine place. I recommend any person that obtains an invitation to go. I have to go there occasionally, sir. I pick up a pass when I sail with the Mediterranean. Only 5.30 shillings. It's like good insurance, sir. It keeps me safe from the pirates and corsairs there.
What cargo do you carry, Captain?
Well, sir, what I bring back from the Mediterranean. Madeira, an excellent wine for the gentry. Would you care for some, sir? I have a couple of pipes. Good value. Spices, sir. Anchovy, we fishies from the Mediterranean, sir, olive oil, all these things, sir, so good profit, they do indeed.
Well, it was nice talking to you, Captain, but we must be on our way. Let's stop at the printing office to buy a copy of the Virginia Gazette, and then we'll go to the Pasteur and Galt Apothecary, where I can buy some tincture for a small cut I picked up in our time machine. No prescription is necessary to buy digitalis, foxglove, or the blood-sucking leeches imported all the way from England. All Williamsburg residents know that using leeches to draw blood from a patient is a common cure for just about every illness, or perhaps a strong motive not to get sick in the first place. But we have to be careful about the physician we choose, because any freeman, with or without medical training, could post a sign announcing he was a doctor. Although Henry, Jefferson, Washington, and other famous men of this time longed for independence, the view was not shared by all Williamsburg residents. Here's how Jane Vobe of the King's Arms Tavern responded when asked about the independence question.
If you're asking of my loyalty towards the king, sir, you must know that I am a loyalist. I hear what the men say. And they say they wish to be free from the rule of the king and to establish here a democracy where they would say what is to happen. They say they would have no taxes at all. Well, George III took back the stamp tax, you know, and I am not willing to give up my cloth and my tea for the sake of politics. English goods are ever the best, sir, and I think the men are doing nothing more than creating hot air.
And the seafaring man, Captain Duncan Stewart, had this to say.
Well, it's difficult to say, sir. There's really no reason in this year of 1770, just because some of His Majesty's ministers, sir, have not seen fit to cease treating us in the colonies like children. Well, I admit the king is like our father, sir, and I'm loyal to him. Besides, sir, who would protect me from the French or the Spanish or the pirates in the Mediterranean? How would we do that, sir? Answer me that.
Well, it's obvious that here in 1770 Williamsburg, people had mixed views about the ties with England. I wish we had more time to talk to some of the other citizens we see here in the streets, storekeepers, craftsmen, gentry, but we have a lot of other things to do. On your next trip to Williamsburg, be sure to strike up a conversation with some of these people. They have a lot of interesting stories. But now it's time for us to go back to the 20th century. In the autumn of 1781, Washington's Continental Army, assisted by French troops under General Rochambeau, effectively ended the Revolutionary War by defeating the British at nearby Yorktown. Williamsburg basked in the international limelight. Historian Park Rouse, author of a wonderful book called Remembering Williamsburg, describes the town at that time and relates a story about one of our earliest heroes, a story that didn't make it into most of our history books.
The French were here for about 6 months after the Battle of Yorktown, and they lived in town and consorted with the natives and were very gallant, and everybody had a grand time, lots of big parties, and General Rochambeau used to ride to the Foxhounds, and he explored this area. He left some very interesting accounts of early Williamsburg. Rochambeau's son had a romance. A very charming local lady ended up being pregnant, and Rochambeau apparently was not in position, young Rochambeau, to marry her. So he had to leave when the French troops left to go back to France, and the young lady ended up having a son who became a famous American naval officer, Lewis Warrington, who was at one time commander of the old U.S. Navy. And Warrington got a lot of wants from his father, saying, I couldn't adopt you when you were little, but now I'm prepared. And the young Warrington wrote him back and said, thank you, but you weren't around when I needed you, so I'm not going to need you now.
Williamsburg remained the capital of Virginia for 80 years. The Revolutionary War, however, had demonstrated that foreign fleets could too easily mount an attack on Williamsburg by sailing up the James or York rivers. Thomas Jefferson had become governor of the state of Virginia, and his home happened to be much closer to Richmond than to Williamsburg. So he exercised one of the perks not uncommon among today's chief executive officers. He supported moving the office closer to home, and the capital was moved to Richmond. Williamsburg's first golden age was over. Park Rouse picks up the story of what life became in Williamsburg.
Williamsburg's great days ended in 1780 when the capital was moved. The town was so desolate, there was all the people who ran the taverns moved to Richmond. The two newspapers moved to Richmond. Most of the lawyers moved to Richmond. The organist at Bruton Parish Church moved to Richmond. The doctors left, and the town shriveled down to about half its original size. And it stayed that way for over 100 years, from 1780 to about 1890. A good story that illustrates the quality of the town. It had lost its money after the Revolution, but there were a lot of fine old families and wealthy widows who lived on here in the big houses, and they tried to make do with what they had, and it wasn't a particularly poor town. It just was a dead one. The college continued, and the Eastern State Hospital continued, but they didn't add a whole lot of money to the proceedings. There was a Confederate officer who died, and they wanted to have a big funeral for him. They asked the local fife and drum corps if they could play a military march, and they said no, the only songs they knew were dance songs. They knew a song called Hop Light Ladies and Cakes All Dough. So they took the body of the dead man, Mr. Gillum, and they started out from the house to the cemetery. They thought they had the coffin, but unfortunately, they were so excited about the parade, they forgot it. They started marching down the street of Williamsburg with the Confederate banners and the little band playing Hop Light Ladies and Cakes All Dough. And finally, a little colored boy ran up after him and said, "Hey, fellows, wait a minute. You forgot the coffin. Mr. Gillum is still back at the house." So they had to turn the parade around and go back, pick up the coffin, and bring him back to the cemetery.
And so Williamsburg drifted off to sleep until, as we shall see later in our story, a country preacher embarked on a crusade that would usher in the second golden age of Williamsburg. But now let's do something a little different for a minute. Throughout our ride today, I'm going to test you with what I refer to as colonial quizzes to see if you actually were snoozing when you should have been listening back in fifth grade. Here's the first one. Are you a Virginian? But careful, don't answer too quickly, because your teacher probably told you that when Williamsburg was the capital, Virginia was a lot bigger than it is today. In fact, it included parts of what are today 10 different states. So if you are from one of those states, you are at least an honorary Virginian. So you think about it a while, and I'll give you the answer a little later in our ride. We've learned that people can only listen to spoken audio for so long before the mind begins to wander. It's unavoidable. Now, I don't want you to miss a word of the Williamsburg story, so I suggest you turn the tape off for a while and just take a break. If you're riding along in your time machine, watch the scenery go by, or maybe catch the news. We still have lots of things to talk about, so don't be gone too long. Talk to you in a few minutes. Welcome back. I trust you are all refreshed and ready to resume our journey. First, let me answer the question about whether you may be a Virginian. You can consider yourself at least an honorary Virginian if you are from any of these states which were once part of the Royal Colony of Virginia. Virginia, of course, Kentucky, West Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Tennessee. It was the time of the Civil War. Union General George B. McClellan and 140,000 superbly equipped soldiers had landed at Union-held Fort Monroe, located on the tip of this peninsula between the York and James River. From there, McClellan planned to lead his mighty host up the peninsula and take Richmond from the east. The Confederates dug two defense lines across the peninsula, the first anchored at Yorktown, the second 10 miles further back just east of Williamsburg. Moving so slowly that some called him the Virginia Creeper, McClellan finally took the Yorktown line on May 4th. As the Confederates retreated, a bloody rearguard action took place the next day at Williamsburg. Dignified in history as the Battle of Williamsburg, it did little but add to the war's growing casualties. In the days that followed, Robert E. Lee assumed command of an army known evermore as the Army of Northern Virginia, and place names on this Virginia peninsula would become bloody markers in our history books. The Chickahominy, Seven Pines, Mechanicsville, Malvern Hill. By August, McClellan's offensive had failed, and he was ordered to return north with the bulk of his army. Williamsburg became a no-man's land. Alternately occupied by the opposing forces, it suffered. Soldiers carted away some of the town's colonial heritage. They ripped bricks from the great old buildings to build chimneys for their huts. When the Union thought Confederate sharpshooters were firing from the windows of the Wren building, they burned it to the ground. Yet in the midst of all that turmoil, there occurred in Williamsburg one of those chivalrous events that marked the early days of the war between the states. Sharp-eyed visitors to Bassett Hall will see etched on a window pane the date Friday, May 23rd, 1862. On that day, a wedding took place. A West Point graduate named John Willis Lee had proposed marriage to a Southern belle who lived at Bassett Hall, then a wealthy planter's Williamsburg home. Before the marriage could be arranged, however, the war broke out, and John joined the Confederate Army. He was soon captured and sent to a Union prisoner of war camp. Lee's West Point classmate, now a captain in the Union Army occupying Williamsburg, helped arrange Lee's parole so that he could marry his Southern sweetheart. As guns blazed nearby, the wedding took place, the groom resplendent in his gray uniform, the best man equally handsome in his uniform of blue. And that's what happened on Friday, May 23rd, 1862, in Bassett Hall, and is most likely the event commemorated by the etching still dimly visible on that pane of glass. But who did the etching? No one is sure, but hereabouts people believe it was done by that Union captain who served as Lee's best man. He had a flair for the dramatic, a flair that 12 years later would lead him to immortality along a stream in Montana called the Little Bighorn, and write indelibly in our history books his name, George Armstrong Custer. After that war, Williamsburg slipped again into drowsy hibernation. Visitors to the town saw little of its past glory. Many of the streets were mud. After a rainstorm, one local wag said that Duke of Gloucester Street was 99 feet wide and 2 feet deep. Many of the most famous buildings had disappeared. All that was left of the Capitol building was a foundation. The governor's palace had been replaced by a school. Many of the houses were in a state of genteel decay. Carpenters had cobbled extra porches, sidings, and floors, camouflaging the original colonial design. A Williamsburg mayor of the time described a typical summer day this way. The straggling street, ankle-deep in dust, chickens ruffling their feathers in perfect safety from any traffic danger, the cows taking refuge from the heat of the sun under the elms along the sidewalk, our city fathers assembled in friendly leisure, following the shade of the old courthouse around the clock, sipping cool drinks and discussing the glories of our past. Almost always, our past. That was the fading vista that met the eye of a country preacher, history scholar, and visionary named Dr. William Archer Rutherford Goodwin. In the 1920s, he was the rector of Bruton Parish Church and part-time fundraiser for William and Mary College. He was described by a contemporary as a stocky man with steel-black hair, deep-set eyes, and very bushy eyebrows. One man claimed he could feel the pressure of the good doctor's hand for 20 minutes after a handshake. Dr. Goodwin would often walk the streets of Williamsburg at night. He said later that he could almost feel the ghosts of Williamsburg's famous past. And somehow, a wild dream began to shape in his mind. It was true that time had altered many buildings, but the basic outline of the Royal Crown Colony's capital city remained. Governor Nicholson's city plan was visible on every street. In fact, the gentle decay that afflicted the town for so many years had actually protected the early colonial structures from the fate that destroyed so many early buildings in America, urban renewal. Yes, Dr. Goodwin had a dream. What if, for the first time in America, an entire town from the colonial era could be restored to its former glory? It would become a living history museum, a once-in-a-lifetime gift to students of all ages who wanted to see their past. But such a vision would cost millions of dollars. Where could such amount of money come from? Reverend Goodwin had a simple, logical answer. From millionaires. And so he began a tireless pursuit. He courted J.P. Morgan, taking him for a wagon ride down Duke of Gloucester Street. J.P. enjoyed the ride and noted that the horse's tack looked rather worn. He offered to donate a new harness to Williamsburg, but that was not what the doctor had in mind. Dr. Goodwin wrote to Henry Ford, and then to Ford's son Edsel. Perhaps the language of his letter was not as tactful as it might have been, considering that he was seeking vast amounts of money. His letter to Edsel read in part, "Unfortunately, you and your father are among the chief contributors to the destruction of this city. The new concrete roads, garages, and gas stations are fast spoiling the whole appearance of the old streets and the old city, and most of the cars which stop at the garages are Ford cars." To the surprise of no one but the ever-persistent Dr. Goodwin, the Fords turned him down flat. Then, Dr. Goodwin's and Williamsburg's fortune took a turn for the better. In 1924, in his capacity as William and Mary fundraiser, he attended a Phi Beta Kappa banquet in New York. His eyes fell on a small, quiet man who was talking with other guests. The doctor was introduced to him, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. Rockefeller. That was the magic word. And on that night, although neither realized it at the time, an incredibly important partnership was forged between the voluble country preacher and the shy, retiring millionaire. At that time, Rockefeller, Jr. was quite a young man. His father still had most of the Rockefeller money, but young John was beginning to do things on his own. Over dinner, Dr. Goodwin talked to him about the Williamsburg project and invited Rockefeller to visit Williamsburg. Not easily put off, Goodwin persisted over the next several years, sending several written invitations, all rejected. Finally, in 1926, he heard through the collegiate grapevine that Rockefeller and his family planned to visit nearby Hampton Institute and wanted to see Yorktown and Williamsburg. Within seconds, Goodwin dispatched an invitation to the Rockefellers to be luncheon guests of William and Mary. Shortly afterwards, he greeted the family, John D. and his wife, and three of their sons, Nelson, David, and Winthrop. On this and subsequent visits, Rockefeller began to show a growing interest. Finally, he took the first tentative steps. He authorized Goodwin to commission some architectural sketches for a restored Wren building. But Rockefeller imposed a severe condition. No one was to know of his involvement. In 1926, town land was selling as low as $500 an acre, and mansions on Duke of Gloucester changed hands for as little as $8,000. If word leaked of Rockefeller interest, speculators would cause prices to skyrocket, putting the whole venture at risk. Dr. Goodwin was confronted with a dilemma. How do you ask an architectural firm to undertake some major work without indicating you had any money to pay for it? We were very fortunate to have an opportunity to talk with Mr. Edwin Kendrew, who in the 1920s was working as a young architect for the firm that eventually received the Williamsburg assignment. Mr. Kendrew later became chief draftsman for the restoration project and later senior vice president of the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. I asked Mr. Kendrew when he first heard of the project.
In 1927, the idea of restoring Williamsburg had been presented to a then unknown sponsor, and he asked that he be remain incognito until it finally decided that he would go ahead with the support of the project. And he said that he didn't want to go ahead with any project unless there was a plan presented to him. So he asked Dr. Goodwin if he knew of someone, some architectural firm or someone who could undertake such a, what today we would today call a feasibility study. Dr. Woodham said yes, he would try and find someone, and the first architectural firm he contacted said, oh, they were too busy, they couldn't undertake such a thing. Perhaps they were persuaded to that point of view by the fact that Dr. Gooden showed no evidence of having very much solid resources in back of it. So he finally asked our firm of Perry Shaw and Hepburn Architects in Boston, where I had been working just a couple of years, and they said yes, they thought it had great possibilities, and that they would be willing to go ahead and make this feasibility study and keep it confidential. So that was really when we set aside part of the office with locked doors to work on the feasibility study, was the time that I first heard of the restoration.
As part of the secrecy arrangement, the preacher and the millionaire devised their own code. When Dr. Goodwin wrote to Rockefeller about a property he wanted to acquire, for example, Rockefeller replied with a telegram. Authorized purchase of antique referred to in your long letter of December 4th. The telegram was signed, David's Father. Soon, despite his well-known caution, Rockefeller was in for a penny, in for a pound, and $5 million was initially committed to bringing an early American town back to life. By this time, there, of course, had been considerable speculation in Williamsburg about the financial backing behind Dr. Goodwin's activities. The secret finally came out at a town meeting on the evening of June 12, 1928, called so Williamsburg citizens could vote on transferring two public greens to a restoration project. Before any votes could be cast, people wanted to know who was really behind all this. Dr. Goodwin rose and began his presentation. Both in its historical associations and in its relics, the town lends itself to a complete restoration. About a year ago, Mr. John D. Rockefeller, Jr. came to Williamsburg. A collective gasp rose from the crowd. Rockefeller, the Reverend, had done it. Williamsburg was to be restored. The vote was 150 in favor, 2 against. The next morning, a local poet trumpeted the news in the Virginia Gazette. My gosh, they've sold the town. My gosh, they've sold the town. And it is said the news has spread for many miles around. They've sold the courthouse green, I dare say, all the people. They'll sell the church, the vestry too, and even sell the steeple. The streets will all come up and the poles will all come down. So take it from me, stranger, it's going to be some town. After working secretly on the project for many months, architect Kendrell finally had an opportunity to come to Williamsburg to see the place that would become his life's work. We asked him of his impression when he first saw Williamsburg.
Well, I had gotten a pretty good impression of the extent of the project, how large the town was in the 18th century from the documents we'd been working with. And so I was asked to come down and to inspect the several of the existing colonial buildings that were particularly in need of repair and bracing for whatever happened in the future. They were really in danger of falling down. It was very exciting to me because it was in May. The daffodils had nearly finished blooming, but quite a lot of them were. The dogwood was in fine state of blooming. Most everyone said the place is falling apart. The 18th century atmosphere has been obliterated with gasoline stations on the main street and modern stores and hay and feed products. And so I was just thrilled with what you might say shown through of the ancient in the midst of this rather disarray modern development.
The early restoration period, with its aura of mystery, produced many interesting stories. One of my favorites is described in Philip Copper's beautiful coffee table book, Colonial Williamsburg. It seems a traveler bound for Williamsburg was stranded on a train platform on a stormy night in Richmond. Trying to make a long-distance call, he found he only had a nickel in his pocket. When the operator asked him to come up with some more money for his call to Williamsburg, he asked if he could reverse the charges. The operator, growing impatient, demanded his name. "Never mind," he sighed. "You wouldn't believe it anyway." And John D. Rockefeller, Jr. hung up the phone. Time for another colonial quiz. This is a simple one. What flag flies over Colonial Williamsburg? Think about it a few seconds. All right. How many said an old American flag? Sorry, it's the 18th century flag of Great Britain. Remember that the Colonial Williamsburg that has been restored was actually the capital of the Crown Colony of Virginia, a British possession. So it's only proper that the British flag of the time fly over the capital. As part of the effort to recreate the total environment of old Virginia, Colonial Williamsburg offers a year-round program of music that features a wide range of styles and musicians. One of the most popular is the Fife and Drum Corps. Fifers and drummers directed the daily life of the 18th century soldier, called into battle, saluted visiting dignitaries, and sustained the marching ranks. As we take another break from our story, let's listen to the Fife and Drums of Williamsburg from a Colonial Williamsburg recording. Well, we've learned a little bit about the history of the Williamsburg area and introduced some of the people who shared the magnificent vision of a restored town. Please turn the tape to side two, and we'll learn how they transformed this vision into a reality.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.